Everybody, my name's Dan Moss, and welcome to today's webinar, Supporting Fathers' Mental Health During the Perinatal Period. This is one of a series of webinars which you may have seen before. It's a joint partnership between CFCA and Emerging Minds. Before I begin today, I'd just like to acknowledge the country that we all meet on today. Just like to acknowledge that I'm sitting here today on Kaurna lands. And pay my respects, as I'm sure you do pay your respects to elders past, present and emerging, as well as to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are joining us today. At Emerging Minds, we'd really also like just to acknowledge the contribution that Aboriginal fathers have made to our work, and particularly in our recent Rebuilding Our Shields Stories from Deadly Dads documentary, which is part of the resources which we'll provide a link to you later on today. And that was just a lovely depiction of some of the values and the commitments that Aboriginal men have to being fathers. So today we're obviously discussing men's mental health as fathers during the perinatal period. That is often described or discussed on this issue. Today we won't be going so far into the issues of working with fathers who use violence or screening for domestic and family violence, or into infant and health and wellbeing, although we understand that those three topics are topics of enormous interest and ones that we just feel need their own specific time slot to really dive into deeply. We just also want to say that we recognise that the research and knowledge in this space is mainly on white, heterosexual or cisgender men. And we would like to acknowledge that families come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. It's important that diversity is considered when working with fathers and families. And we also have some resources on inclusive practice with rainbow families, which can be found in the webinar's resources, as I discuss at the end of this webinar. So before any further ado, I would love to introduce you to our fantastic panelists today. First up, we have Carol Dapp, who is currently doing some amazing research for her PhD, and she's focusing on men's mental health during the pregnancy period. Lovely to have you here today, Carol. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
Next up, we have Kirsty Lowe, who's a lecturer at Flinders University. And Kirsty has over 20 years' experience working in the infant mental health space. Welcome, Kirsty.
Thanks, Dan.
And our third panellist today is a new father, or a newish father, Claudius. Claudius is a child and family partner at Emerging Minds. And we know Claudius really well because he's contributed a lot to our e-learning courses and also to podcasts and filmed interviews. It's lovely to have you here today, Claudius, to share some of your personal experience.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Claudius.
Okay, so we're going to start off just asking our panelists some questions about their particular research or practice or lived experience. And Carol, I'm going to start with you because I'm really fascinated by your research in this area of men's mental health during the perinatal period. Can you tell us a little bit about some of fathers' experiences throughout this period?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a period of big transition and change for fathers, and part of the transitional experience of this perinatal period is that men are likely to experience quite a range of concerns and worries, and this is actually developmentally appropriate, but in some cases fathers are not able to control the frequency or the extent of their worries and concerns. And this can actually feed into the development of anxiety symptoms, which are strongly linked to the development of depression as well. And so the perinatal period, even though fathers go into it thinking it's going to be all fun and exciting, they actually might experience issues with their mental health. So research shows that about 10% of fathers experience depression during pregnancy and then after the birth, and that can even increase after 3 to 6 months. So 3 to 6 months after the birth, fathers may experience 25% of fathers may experience depression at that time, and then in terms of anxiety, 25% of fathers have been reported to experience anxiety symptoms during pregnancy, which drops down to about 18% after the birth. And then and some men are experiencing postnatal depression. About 5% of men, experience post-traumatic stress disorder after they witness traumatic childbirth of their child. So in terms of the bigger picture, men are experiencing difficulties in different ways, and their concerns can feed into that. So during pregnancy particularly, men might worry about the health of their baby, their partner's health, whether or not their partner is receiving adequate health care, whether or not they themselves as fathers are adequately supporting their pregnant partner, whether they have what it takes to be great parents, the responsibility that comes with parenthood, the change of lifestyle. So there's a lot that they're thinking about, a lot, they're weighing up a lot, and often they don't voice these concerns because they don't want to take care away from their partners or add to the concerns of their partners, or they feel that actually it's a sign of weakness to have these concerns. And, you know, what man feels this way during pregnancy or after pregnancy? And so they don't speak up. So, that's why this topic is really important.
Great, thanks for that, Carol. Kirsty, lots of men, and Carol touched on this, are really trying to find ways to kind of connect with their newborn baby and their partner at the earliest possible stage. But I suppose there are also, you know, still some barriers that that can occur for fathers within systems to allow them to do that. I'm wondering, given your experience in the field, whether you could describe some of those barriers.
Sure, Dan. I think practitioners are becoming increasingly aware of some of that research that Carol's talking about and the importance to engage dad. And I guess, you know, the numbers of people that are here today, you know, a testament to that. But there are certainly, it's more complex than just whether dads can't, you know, what's happening for them and whether they can access support. The services, I don't think, have caught up to how to, you know, address the needs of dads. And so things like when and where services are provided is still a barrier. So services are generally provided still during business hours when a lot of dads would be working. There's not that flexibility around access. There can also be things like probably service design is still focused around women-centric services, and so there's not additional resources put into it. Like, it's quite different to work with a family unit versus, you know, just a single caregiver and the child. And so things like, you know, additional time for visits or the work that you're doing. I know in my experience, you know, if a dad was present and I was working with him and the mother, it's two lots of screening tools, additional documentation, those sorts of things. And I don't think the service design and systems have caught up. There can also be, like I said, you know, where services are established around working with women, even the way we record information, you know, doesn't really equip us to be able to capture the work that we're doing and the issues for dad. So our data systems were set up around a single primary caregiver. So then what do we do with the information after we've met with the dad? How does it get recorded? How do you maintain the confidentiality and privacy, those sorts of things? So so I think absolutely, practitioner awareness is growing, but there are still how do we actually tackle this in a way that we can provide the best service to dads and families?
Thanks, Kirsty. And Claudius, so you've not that long ago gone through these experiences yourself, and we know You as a very engaged father and have kind of really wanted to be as engaged as possible right from the get-go. I'm wondering whether we could start by asking you a little bit about your experiences or reflections as a first-time parent.
Yes, of course, for sure. First, I have to say, Carol and Kirsty, I completely agree with pretty much everything that you said. My experiences when my wife got pregnant, I like to be a giving person, and any concerns or things that I had during my wife's pregnancy for myself, you know, needs for myself, I kind of pushed to the back of my activities while I focused on my wife. And all the concerns that you listed, Carol, I felt those at various stages. You know, like, is my wife okay? Is the baby okay? How am I to be how do I go about being a supportive father? What kind of a father am I going to be? How do I be the best? I perhaps overthought some of it. But it does compound. And yeah, unfortunately, there was no one to say that you know, if you overthink this too much, it's going to come to a head later on. And I found that after my son was born, that mixed in with the fatigue in the early weeks, the fatigue brought on enormous feelings of depression and guilt. That you know, I wish that somebody had said, you know, fatigue can do this to you. You need to be aware of it. And it wasn't until I actually went to my GP and I said to my GP that, you know, I have all these, you know, intense feelings. You know, is it what is the cause of it? And it wasn't until he explained to me, it's okay. You're doing everything right. This is just fatigue that's causing this. And Kirsty, you know, I completely understand where you're coming from in terms of, you know, the additional workload, including the father, in these visits and the documentation associated with it. I can vouch for the fact that a lot of the times when my wife was receiving appointments with medical practitioners during the pregnancy, and I may have been present, I wasn't really considered, if that helps support what you have available to you. I was more of an incidental, you know, dare I say it, someone to help my wife in and out of the room, you might say. But nobody really considered what kind of an impact this life-changing event would have on me as an individual and my thought processes. So I absolutely get what you've been talking about, and that's my take, that's my observation from my experiences in this.
Claudius, can I just ask you one more question?
Yes.
You mentioned that before a GP who gave you some advice. It sounds like he might have been someone who was able to you know, take your individual needs as a father kind of mind. What was it about him, do you think, that allowed that to happen?
The GP that we were seeing at the time, he's a very blunt man. He you know, he sees the issue and he can see everything in front of it. And it's like straight forward. but not in a harsh way. If you're obviously in discomfort, he addresses the issue and you know, highlights the, you know, the positive aspects of your work. And explains that, you know, what you're feeling, you know, is not is the way that you're feeling it is is not accurate, and he has a gentle way of, you know, directing you, you know, to the correct conclusions. I mean, to not put too fine a point on it, what I had originally been feeling, you know, as a result of the fatigue, was intense guilt that I had contributed to bringing my son into the world. You know, this is a hard world. You can't dress it any other way. You have to work hard here. And I felt terrible that I'd brought my son into this world where he will eventually have to work hard. And I'm a bit of a soft individual, and that it came to a head one morning when I, you know, went into the bedroom, you know, after, you know, having the night shift looking after him, and I knelt down by the bed next to my wife, and I was like, what have I done? And, you know, it was at that point that we both decided, you know, no, we need to go to our GP and we need to discuss this, because, you know, this is extremely intense and perhaps disproportionate to the reality of the situation. And yes, no, when I saw my GP, he listened and he reassured me, you know, in a calm, gentle yeah. voice. He didn't disregard what I was saying. He just, you know, it's like, I hear what you're saying. I can understand how you were feeling, but it is not the case. You are doing everything correct, and what you are feeling is a result of your fatigue, and that fatigue is feeding depression. And surprisingly enough, that's really all I needed to hear. As soon as I heard that, I understood this was being caused by that. And with that understanding, I was more mentally equipped to deal with it, despite the fatigue that I felt.
Thank you, Claudius. That's, yeah, really lovely insight. Thank you. Kirsty, I want to ask you now, sometimes practitioners who work mainly with mothers or with women might talk about some hesitancy in working with men or fathers. They might perhaps have worked with men or fathers in the past who have been difficult to engage, or they might have had experience where a man perhaps has demonstrated, you know, an attitude of contempt towards his partner. Can you tell me a little bit about what are some of the ways that you as a practitioner have mm-hmm. found to overcome hesitancy or ambivalence, and how this might be useful for other practitioners?
Sure, Dan. I think, you know, there can be a lot going on for practitioners in this space. And, you know, absolutely a lot of people have got their own experiences of, you know, working with men where there maybe has been some challenging behaviour. You know, we also are the result of, you know, beliefs in society that, you know, parenting might be more women's business, those sorts of things. And so we take that with us. I think there's also can be a sense and a hesitation around, you know, our own discomfort in these situations. And I guess I've, you know, while we need to be really, really mindful of worker safety and the safety of women and children in these situations, I guess it's like, how do you balance that? How do you maintain that focus on absolutely we need to do risk assessment and be very aware of the risk, but also not let that be a barrier to our engagement? And I think one concept that I found really helpful, and not just in working with dads, but across other situations as well, is the idea of ports of entry, that there are a number of different ways that we can enter working with somebody, and it's about finding that right avenue. And I think for some of the dads I've worked with, that port has been not through taking head on, I guess challenging head on maybe some of those behaviours, but using their wishes, their hopes, their dreams for the way they want to parent or their relationship with their child as then the avenue to access and work with those dads to build that relationship, to maintain some compassion for them, and I guess maybe maintain some hope that things can be a bit different for them and their, you know, the way they parent or how they're going. So I think that's been particularly helpful is, you know, thinking about that, and that might be, while we might not need stay there the whole time, that might be at least the point that we can start having some of these conversations. So for example, if a dad's, you know, the father of a daughter, how can you start then lifting up what you know, some of his behaviours might mean for that experience of, and what he hopes for his daughter's experience in life to be, those sorts of things. Yeah, and I think, you know, sometimes, you know, in my experience there, you know, despite the discomfort, despite, you know, my hesitancy, it was really important to name some of my concerns or, the, you know, some of those challenges. And I guess there's one family in particular that I can think of where they were some of the most exhausting conversations I've had. But it was really important because I could see when the dad was in the room, the important role he played in that little person's life, that he was the more consistent parent and the safe parent for her. And so how important it was to have him present, you know, that was really, really critical. And so at times we did have to agree to disagree. Some of his views around discipline or the way you parent or the impact of his own and his partner's mental health on the baby, we saw things differently, but we still had those conversations. I still lifted up and said that this is what my experience tells me. And so that may have been the first time that either of those parents had heard some of that information, you know, some of it's developmental information, those sorts of things. But I think I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't raise those concerns or give that information.
And I just want to ask you, Kirsty, what difference, you know, as you've gone along and become really committed to asking fathers about their hopes and their wishes and their dreams, what difference do you think that's made for them in their engagements with you?
I think it feels like a more genuine engagement for them, that I'm not just there in the service of working, you know, with their partner, or, you know, that I am there to listen. You know, I am genuinely and authentically want to hear their experiences and their stories. So sometimes, you know, they have opened up about, you know, their own experiences of growing up, what it felt like for them, those sorts of things, and been able to share that. And of course, that makes sense then about, you know, some of their ideas around how you parent or what you do with your mental health, those sorts of things.
And I suppose also so many men start to develop a sense of commitment to their own children because they want to be different to how they might have been with their own dads or stepfathers or
Yeah. And sometimes the first reaction is, well, I was brought up this way and I'm okay. But sometimes if you can kind of stick with it and see that through, you know, you do start to hear where actually they want something different. And that goes for a lot of mums too. You know, you hear that story a lot from a lot of mums, so for both parents. And often it's the, but I don't know what to do differently. You know, this is all I know.
Yeah, thanks, Kirsty. Carol, lots of what your research currently is thinking about, you know, the importance of investing in healthy fathers and, you know, fathers' mental health, because that means that they're able to support partners and babies much better. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what you found in that area?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the research on this is so overwhelmingly clear that it motivates me and should motivate others to support fathers during this period. So for instance, if a man's doing poorly in his mental health, there are strong links to his partner also doing poorly in her mental health, and then that obviously has negative outcomes for her and for her infant, you know, during the perinatal period. So there's that link between the couple and how they're both doing in terms of their mental health. And then there's the link of if a husband or a partner is able to give good support to his pregnant partner, that's actually linked to really good outcomes. So women who receive good partner support during pregnancy have lower rates of depression during pregnancy and after childbirth, better health outcomes also. So for instance, you know, women who don't receive good partner support are more likely to experience a preterm birth, more likely to experience their baby being born at low birth weight or having a low ABCAR score. So real ramifications there for support. And then, you know, if we think beyond the support that fathers provide, their partners, there's also the impact of fathers on their children, which Kirsty really touched on in such a lovely way. And the research shows that men with postnatal depression are less likely to engage in positive father-child interactions, such as play or reading with their infants. They are more likely to be a bit less responsive to their infants. Their children exhibit outcomes. So, for instance, children of fathers who have experienced postnatal depression have a higher rate of negative reactivity as an infant, and then they may develop emotional and behavioral problems as toddlers, right up until 7 years of age. There's been research to show that these children may develop psychological and social difficulties. So the mental health of fathers is important, not just for themselves and their partners, but also really important for their children's outcomes. And really, we do need to talk about the men themselves. If they're doing poorly with their mental health, they're more likely to experience persistent fatigue after the birth. They're more likely to experience parenting as a stressful experience. They're less confident in their ability to parent, and many of them experience sleeping difficulties. So when you think about all these different connective outcomes and how, you know, supporting men really would support not just themselves but the whole family unit, it's a pretty critical time really for men.
Thanks, Carol. And Claudius, for you, and you touched on this in your last answer, why is it crucial, do you think, for practitioners to be not just considering one parent or the other, to be thinking about, you know, a family unit, however that looks, and to be, you know, assessing the individual needs of every parent or each parent that comes to a service?
Well, I think the answer is reasonably simple, Dan, that you know, when you think about a family unit, you know, like the mother or the father, whether a wife or partner, it is a joint partnership. You almost never hear about any circumstance where it's, you know, where there is a partnership where only one individual does all of the work. You know, a mother, a child, you know, in a mother and father environment, is exposed to both. And I think if, you know, the mother and the father have access to medical mental health care or anything else like that, it is important to include both and consider them not as individuals, but as a whole, so that at the end of the day, information is clear and complete and transparent, and there's no ambiguity, if that's a reasonable word to use, with the information that is given, so that both parties understand the situation completely and clearly, no matter what side you're on. And I think that leads to a more solid and supportive understanding in the family unit. If that's a fair thing to say. I mean, that's my perspective. I mean, that's my perspective on it.
Absolutely, and a very very interesting and insightful perspective. So thank you, Claudius. We're now going to move on. We're going to talk a little bit now about. I'm just going to talk about some. Practice tips or practical advice, because I think what we've covered is that it is important, you know, like that this is a really important part of work in the perinatal infant mental and parental mental health space. Carol, I might start with you. given we, you know, your research does show, and you've talked about this so unequivocally, the importance of engaging with men, what does the research also say about what works to support fathers?
Yeah, so there's obviously a lot more to be done in this space. Firstly, you know, the leading researchers around the world are recommending that fathers are routinely screened for mental health difficulties during the prenatal as well as the postnatal period, so preferably in conjunction with their partners, and that's really important. But as yet, there aren't any specifically designed screening tools that have been developed for use in men during the perinatal period when they experience quite unique concerns and issues. And so at the moment, in terms of recommendations that are out there, men are being screened using the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, but it's recommended that a lower cut score be used in men. So a score of around 6, which is lower than the score used in women. And clinicians need to be mindful that low mood in men is sometimes exhibited in symptoms that are not picked up by the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. So, for instance, anger or irritation, they're things that practitioners need to kind of be tuning into as a gauge of how men are coping during that period. And then in terms of anxiety, the screeners that are currently being recommended are the general anxiety screeners, like the DAS-21, which are good screeners, but they can miss men who are specifically struggling with pregnancy-related anxiety, which is a subtype of anxiety in which they do worry about all the aspects of pregnancy and the transition. And so in conjunction with a general anxiety scale, it's good practice for clinicians to be having open dialogue with fathers about whether they're experiencing any concerns, what they might be, how frequently are they experiencing these concerns, and whether their worries are starting to interfere with their sleep or becoming difficult to control, because those are signs that men are not really at that adaptive level of worry where they're planning for the future, but they're starting to really have this cyclical worry that's feeding into potentially the development of anxiety. So just to be mindful of that. And then in terms of supporting fathers, the literature emphasises the importance of being proactive and asking fathers about themselves rather than waiting for fathers to seek help themselves. If therapy is needed, we're still using, CBT and interpersonal therapy as the main approaches that seems to work well during this period. The SMS for Dads text messaging support service, which has a huge amount of research behind it, very accessible to fathers and a way for men to normalise some of their experiences and get some help around that. There's research being done in terms of providing men with specific like psychoeducational sessions, support type sessions, but what the research shows is that those types of sessions are better done if they're presented to men within the context of already attending a couple's antenatal type service or classes, and if they are advertised to fathers, they should be advertised as practical skills building, not as a come along and talk about your thoughts and feelings because we're worried about you, because men aren't likely to respond to that. And also having one-off sessions for men, you know, rather than making them sign up to a 6-session program. So that's pretty much all I can say on the research end with that.
Great, thank you, Carol. Yeah, there's a lot of information there. Thank you. It's really comprehensive. What about for you, Kirsty, in your practice? What are some of the techniques or the tools or the considerations that you've used to be able to engage men more fully throughout the pregnancy or early years of a child's life?
Yeah, sure, Dan. I mean, I guess building on from what Carol was saying, I mean, we did use a number of screening tools in the work that we did, the ones that she mentioned, like the DAS21, those sorts of things. And I guess for me, it was important to think about the purpose of those screening tools and not seeing them as a replacement for the conversations I needed to be having with dads or with any of the parents, really. And what sometimes they were really helpful to open up conversations, you know, maybe almost naming some of the taboo areas or, you know, being able to wonder about what might be happening for someone, you know, given a certain score, those sorts of things. But it was also important to think about, well, you know, what do you do next? Where do you, you know, how do you support a dad to then access their actual supporting needs around what screening tools shown? You know, is that something that I can provide? Those sorts of things. So absolutely had a place, really helpful as a piece of information, but then still needing to think about, well, what do you do next? I think one thing that we did was sometimes the support we provided to fathers was kind of not direct. It was almost through the work I was doing with mothers. So, you know, it was almost like even though dads weren't in the room, we were still needing to lift up their experience. And so, you know, some of that was just through wondering about the dad's experience, wondering about what's happening for the dad. You know, a mum often might express concerns about changes in behaviour that she'd noticed, you know, the irritability, the reluctance to be involved with the care of the infant, some of those sorts of things. And so I guess it would be some education and information for her that she could either, you know, to help her out, but also to take back and share. Sometimes in the work that I did, I also worked with supporting other practitioners, and that was really helpful to, I guess, just take that, again, that wondering position of sometimes other practitioners would come to a really definite position about what a dad's behaviour meant. And it might be about joining with a, you know, with a mum in saying, or, you know, he's being, I don't know, a bit of a jerk in this moment, for lack of, you know, better word. But sometimes it would be, you know, if you can wonder about, well, what else might be explaining that behaviour, what might be happening for dad. And I mean, there was one instance where I think the infant had a chronic health issue, and dad was a nurse, his profession was a nurse, and so there was this expectation that dad would be the one that would administer the treatment and the therapies and things like that to the child. And there was a real resentment towards the dad when he wasn't able to do that. And so it was like, well, it was almost these assumptions of, well, he just should do that. And so when we stepped back from it, it could be, well, what else might be, has anyone asked dad how he's going? You know, what is it like to actually be expected to be the nurse to your own child? What's it like for him to have a child with a chronic health issue? Some of those sorts of things. And so it just allowed us, you know, I guess a different perspective, different avenues to do some work. In terms of when dads are in the room, I think some of the most basic approaches are the same sorts of things we do with anybody, being genuine, being authentic, but really specifically and explicitly inviting him into the conversations, asking specifically about his experience. Because I think sometimes dads are a bit lost about, am I meant to be in this? Am I not meant to be involved? You know, what do I do? And then I guess also, you know, warming up to questions maybe about his emotional well-being and inquiring about that. So maybe using something like sleep deprivation as a way to begin having those conversations, rather than going straight for the, you know, the emotions and the feelings, which might then be more off-putting and uncomfortable. So that's some of the things that we are used. Yeah.
Thanks, Kirsty. So Claudius, for you as a new father, so you may have been asked some of these questions or gone through some of these assessments which Kirsty and Carol have talked about. What sort of questions or engagement strategies worked for you, or if they didn't, weren't employed with you, what would have you liked to have been asked as a new father?
I have to say, Carol, Kirsty, if I had known about any of those strategies, I think they would have helped a lot. Unfortunately, to the best of my recollection, which is pretty reasonable at best, I can't recall ever experiencing them. I mean, the times that I did go with my wife to her medical visits, I literally was sitting in a chair, just listening to the general practitioner speaking to my wife about how things were going. And I don't think once they asked me how I was going. You know, like, what's your take on this? Do you have any concerns or anything else? No, it was all directed at my wife. Not that I'm complaining about that, because, you know, she was carrying the baby. She was carrying Christopher. But at the same time, you know, I was putting a lot of effort in. I felt like I was putting a lot of effort in. I was looking after her. I was concerned for her. I was concerned for her health. I was concerned for Christopher's health. But no, not to the best of my recollection do I recall ever being screened or asked, how's my sleep going? Or, you know, am I fatigued? Or any feelings of depression? No, I don't recall that I ever was asked any of these, which is surprising that you actually that mentioned that they exist. And it's like, I wish that somebody had. I do wish that somebody had asked, because I would have said that, you know, that there are times that I'm exhausted, but I keep going. That I'd like to know whether or not I'm doing this correctly. But no, a lot of it was intuition on my part. It's like, I you know, my wife is pregnant, she's tired, she's carrying around my little boy, but I don't want her to have to do the work or to think that she has to do the work. It's, you know, she's already doing half the work. At the very least I can pick it up. And that's what I felt that I went through the whole 9 months that she was pregnant.
So. And Claudius, like, when I hear you talking like this, it's like the very papers that I read in my study are coming alive with your voice. You know, your experiences are not the exception. They seem to be very, very common for men, that they're never asked how they're going in terms of their sleep, their mental health, their coping, their concerns. And and yeah, it's quite sad that there are ways to help men, but yeah, they're often overlooked.
I wonder would like sometimes. To say that. I just wanted to say that, you know, despite what I'm just saying there, I'm not saying that the practitioners that we went and saw were not doing their job. Mm. They were doing a wonderful job. Mm. But I think that there were, you know, aspects of development that were potentially neglected, or that they were not aware to pursue. Yes, I'm happy for the work that the practitioners did, but I feel that, you know, there were other areas that they could have taken into consideration had they, you know, had the tools at their disposal and that they were aware to use them.
So I was just going to say, from a practitioner perspective, I wonder whether some of it is that lack of awareness or those assumptions that get made, that it's, the experience is different for dads and it's not significant, that they're not going through the physical changes of carrying the baby. And so it's almost not through a not wanting to include dads, but it's just kind of out of mind. Like, you just make us, you know, because I guess the knowledge hasn't been there until this point about just how difficult the transition is for men as well, you know, those sorts of things. Not to say we shouldn't do better, but I wonder if there's some of that going on.
Possibly. I mean, I know that when I visited the practitioners with my wife, that, you know, I tried to present shall we say, as strong and supportive individual as I possibly could be. And, you know, a lot of the times I feel, most likely to my own detriment, that I masked the things that were weighing on me. And I, as I said before, I put them to the back.
Thanks, Claudius, and thanks everyone for their answers. We've got some live questions and answers coming through from you, the audience, which is fantastic. Thank you, and keep them coming. We'll try to get through as many of those as we can in the next little while. But one of the questions that's coming through is, how do we prepare men? How do we prepare men, particularly having been fathers before, and help them in that period to adjust to fatherhood? Carol, I might start with you with that one. What does the research say in terms of what we can do to actually help men to feel as much as possible kind of in a solid position to kind of be getting their head around some of the new challenges?
A part of it is normalizing their experiences. So men struggle more when they feel like they're not receiving enough support. And part of support is being able to say to someone, look, this can be a tough time. And if you are having difficulties, it doesn't reflect on you in terms of your strength as a human being. It's common that people struggle, and you know, sometimes advertisements on TV or Father's Day, you know, makes it look like parenthood is this wonderful, you know, you're at the playground pushing your child on the swings all day and it's just so exciting and wonderful all the time. And maybe, you know, during the antenatal, prenatal period, you know, it might be worth for people to, you know, kind of normalize the fact that it's also got its rough times, you know. And I don't know, just normalizing it for men, because one of the things that comes through in the research is that they felt very alone in their experiences. So they might have experienced anxiety or depression, but they thought they were the only ones. They didn't appreciate that this is a legitimate experience, and they're not the only ones, and others have made it through and they can also.
And just while while you're answering that, Carol, another couple of questions that are coming through our audience are really kind of asking you what the research might say about men who still have an expectation that they work really hard, long hours, and continue to do that while they're parenting in the early years. What might be some of the implications or effects of that?
That's actually another source of stress for these men. Juggling work commitments with family commitments, it can actually feed into feelings of you know, low mood and not being able to kind of meet expectations in both parts of their lives, you know, because they're, you know, a lot of them feel the financial responsibility to, you know, to care for their entire family, and then plus the work demands, and then the family demands. It's actually one of the significant stresses for men. It's a tricky one, because by doing well in their workplaces, they're supporting their families, but at the same time, they sometimes get this conflicting message that they're not doing enough, and it's actually really difficult for them to find that balance.
Thank you, Carol. Yeah, great answer. Kirsty, a question for you that we've got here is, in your experience, how can practitioners support men who have existing mental health issues that they may already be seeking support about, but I'm concerned that that being a new father might actually exacerbate those mental health concerns?
I guess part of it is, you know, having open conversations with dads, inquiring about their experience, you know, thinking about maybe things about what would be the warning signs that you're not coping as well as you had been. Even, you know, I guess, you know, plans around what do you do? How do we manage this if you're noticing changes? Because, you know, it might be, there might be through some additional stresses or those sorts of things that it might be an exacerbation. I guess it's also being realistic with them about how do they'll make like, that adjustment and manage, you know, their mental health with the additional demands that they've got, you know, when they might be up helping with settling a baby overnight and those sorts of things. And so I guess, you know, building partnerships with their, you know, the other people that are supporting them, whether it's the GP or a psychologist or those sorts of things, and being collaborative and having open conversations around how can we wrap support around this person to make sure that, you know, they're equipped, that they've got the information, and, you know, we provide them with some strategies to manage when they need it.
Mm. Claudia, it's a question for you from the audience. So Kirsty talked about talking to men or new fathers about their hopes, goals, and dreams for their children. How important do you think that is? You know, like when you were knew that you were going to be a first-time dad, was this something that, you know, was a really important thought for you about what you wanted for your newborn child? And what would have it been like to have someone ask you about that within a service system?
That is a very weighty question for me, because, you know, as you can imagine, you always want the best for your children. Always. There is no point in your life where you're like, oh, you know, they'll figure something out. No, you want to invest your heart into providing the most secure path for them in life, to the point where they can make their own decisions. And that often takes up a lot of your mental capacity. Are you keeping them healthy? Are you, you know, laying the framework in the future? And that starts early. It starts very early. You know, and the things you have to consider is like health, you know, physical and mental, financial health. You know, where are they going to go, you know, later when they study? How well do they interact socially? Is there anything that you can do to help? I never got asked any of this when he was born. I think maybe there's an assumption that, you know, that's for someone else to work out. But I can tell you that it weighs very heavily in my mind, that, you know, on a daily basis, that, you know, I push to, you know, try and lay the foundations for something that will benefit him later in life.
Mm. And not asking you to talk for other men, of course, but how think that is for, you know, all fathers to be thinking about what they hope for their child, whether that's, you know, a different childhood to the one that they experience, or some similarities, or something completely different. How important is it to be planning for that as a dad?
I feel for myself that it is very important, because, you know, when your child grows up and they achieve, you know, that completion of what they want to do, there should be an incredible amount of pride in a father, in the knowledge that they contributed to this and they helped their child succeed. I mean, when you think about it, if you are emotionally and physically bound to somebody, you know, in a way that, you know, a father is to their child, that almost nothing can give you greater happiness and contentment knowing that everything that you did to help your child become who they want to be later in life. It's, you know, that could be, you know, one of your single greatest achievements, you know, throughout your entire life. And when you think, you know, if you live to be, you know, 80 or 90 years old and you helped your child become the greatest that they could be, you know, that's a heartwarming, that's a sobering experience. Now, that's how I feel about it. And I would like to think that there are many men out there who are first time fathers and they feel the same, whether they voice it or not. It is something that they aspire to, and they fight on a daily basis their circumstances to try and lay their own foundations to make this happen. And sometimes it's a silent fight.
Thank you, Claudius. Time for one quick more question from the audience. This is for you, Carol. Does the evidence show that dads today are more committed to spending genuine time, you know, a bit like Claudius has said, with their, you know, newborn babies, but throughout their childhood than they have been in previous generations?
Yeah, definitely. They are wanting to be more involved from the get-go. They want to be more involved during pregnancy, but definitely once the baby is born, and involvement has increased on the part of men. So that's just wonderful. I think, you know, outcomes for families are much better when men are involved in this way. So, but the system doesn't support men to be as involved as they want to be. So they don't get access to the same amount of parental leave that, you know, is really supporting them to be as involved as they want to be. So there's a strong societal expectation that men are more involved during the perinatal period, but they're still up against some pretty big hurdles to make it happen.
I agree completely with what you said, because when my son was born, I believe I only had 2 weeks off from work, and the rest of the time I actually had to take as annual leave from my job. And at the time I was working in a winery as the head laboratory technician, testing all the wine samples, and they were about to start vintage. So I essentially went back to work about a week before vintage started. And, you know, vintage in a winery is the busiest time in a winery. There are 12-hour shifts almost completely around the clock. So I completely understand what you're saying, and I can fully support that.
And not all men have the flexibility or the adaptability or even access to annual leave. Not all men have annual leave, you know?
Thank you, Claudia. Thank you to our panelists. We're just running out of time, Carol and Claudia, so I'm kind of cutting you off there. I apologise, but I could ask you questions for all day. I think this has been such an insightful and fascinating conversation. We look forward to joining you in our next webinar between CFCA and Emerging Minds. But for now, can you please join in thanking me? I've just had a wonderful time listening to the expertise and experiences of Carol, Claudius and Kirsty. Thank you all so much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
No problem. Thank you.